Welcome to Settlement Nation. I am Courtney Barber, and today I'm bringing you an interview with two guests you won't want to miss. In this multiple-part series, I chat with Jason Neville from the Jerry Spence Firm and Jacob Norman from Trial Lawyers for Justice, both respected and seasoned plaintiff and trial attorneys who started their careers working for the defense. In this multi-part series, we take you behind the scenes of the defense perspective, discussing the inner workings of the defense counsel, insurance adjusters, their tactics, how they build their cases, and how you can leverage this knowledge to maximize your case values and get more money more often. So welcome, Jason and Jacob.
Hi, Courtney. Hi, Jacob.
Hello.
So to jump right in, Jason, I heard from the background research that I've done on you, you actually worked on the defense side for 19 years before you came over to the plaintiff side. Can you give our listeners a little bit of background on how you started and share your story?
Sure. So I started actually with my father's firm, Williams Porter Day & Neville, and worked there for about 19 years and doing everything, you know, from the insurance defense side, from, you know, starting out little car wrecks and soft tissue cases, moving on to medical negligence and products cases, and in Wyoming, where I primarily practiced a lot of oil field wrecks, explosions, and things like that.
And so you working on that side, what sort of gave you the, what was the moment that made you then transition over to the plaintiff side?
Well, I hated what I was doing for a long, long time. It's, you know, some people can do it. I got no enjoyment from it, no fulfillment.
And Jacob, you also started out in the defense, which is really interesting. And for a lot of listeners, this is not the norm, I think. And from what I've heard, most people usually pick a side and they stay on either side of the fence. But you also started out in the defense. What was that like? And what prompted you to come to the plaintiff side?
Well, yeah, in the weird small world that it is, it's actually Jason's fault. I started on the defense. So after law school, I was finishing up law school in 2002, shortly after the September 11th attacks, and I'd been called to active duty. At the time, I was an infantryman in Pennsylvania, then had moved to Wyoming, and I was on active duty as a law school graduate checking IDs at people coming the gate. And Jason's firm actually was looking for someone, and I think he'd found out I had been back in the area, and he reached out to me and let me know they were looking for someone. So I interviewed, and next thing you know, I'm a defense attorney. As far as switching, it was interesting for me. I obviously didn't make it 19 years like Jason, but I really respected one of Jason and I's partners. And saw what was he doing to be successful. And it really meant working 60 to 70 hours a week. I used to make him binders that he would then take to work while he was supposed to be seeing his kids at college break. And it just kind of made me keep thinking, like, gosh, is that what, if that's what success is, that's like not only a lot of work, I didn't think I could be happy doing that. And there's an old guy in town that year between Jason, myself, and other attorneys at the firm, we must have paid the guy millions in settlements. So it just made me wonder, well, if that guy, every time I try and get a hold of him, he's at the country club, and this guy that I respect in our firm is always at the pool studying when he's actually supposed to be at the pool with his kids. Is that really what I want my life to be like? And it kind of made me think that the switch was not only in my best interest, I'd find a little bit more happiness representing people than insurance companies.
It's funny, you know, Jacob, as you say that, when I first started talking with the Spence firm and going through about a 3-month torturous ordeal about, you know, am I going to leave the firm that I grew up in, you know, that I've always been a part of since a little boy, quite frankly. I was out doing depositions in California, in a medical case, and coming back with one of the older, he was a co-defendant, defense counsel. And we were in the Salt Lake Airport in the Crown Room, and it's a Friday night. it's about 7:30 or 8, and we're sitting there, and I'm having a drink because my day's over, right? I'm just waiting to come back to Casper. And he's there pounding out a deposition report at 8:30 at night. And I thought, my God, is that going to be me in 25 years? Is that something that can happen? And that was a moment, quite frankly, that just solidified it for me of no way, I can't do this.
Well, it's glad to see you both came over to the plaintiff side. And that's very in line with what we do also at Independent Life with, you know, fighting for injury victims and getting justice for them. But now we're going to jump straight into the juicy part of this conversation. This is what everyone here came for. This is the prize fight of the night. Last Trial by Human webinar that they had with Nick Rowley and Dan Shah, reserves came up. And a lot of attorneys on the webinar found the whole process really fascinating and wanted to know more. And obviously that wasn't the whole focus of the webinar, so we didn't have enough time. But Jason and Jacob, I want you to take it from here and take our listeners through, you know, the defense perspective. How does all this work? What are the behind the scenes tips and tools that they can learn about that they wouldn't know because they don't have your experience? And I really share that knowledge with them so they can use it. So first off, how do reserves work?
Yeah, well, it's a great question, and it's something that, you know, you really can't go out and find a book about because they keep all of that stuff secret. And, you know, what I have learned about it is what I've learned through about 19 years of getting bits and pieces, usually from frustrated insurance adjusters, as they reveal some of this stuff. And as they reveal it, they always say, I'm not supposed to tell you this. What I've taken away from it is that reserves really control the flow of the case. And a lot of times, quite frankly, the outcome, if you can't push back on them, you know, they are initially set, but not by the defense counsel. The defense counsel are not supposed to be involved in it. They're not supposed to know about it, ever know about it. Right. But they have a key hand in setting those reserves. And they do it by the initial litigation report. And every insurance company, you know, has their own modality and their own outline for defense counsel to use. And one of those is what is the likely outcome of the case. And it can be as simple as a quick little paragraph of what you think, you know, a settlement value is, you know, what a high verdict, low verdict, median verdict might be. And is this case a runaway? Some carriers, I mean, it is just sort of pages, and I'm not kidding, pages of, you know, what's a high-low verdict, what's a high-median verdict, and it gets extraordinarily frustrating. But the importance of that for the insurance company is then the adjuster takes that information and then they independently set the reserve. And that is what is sort of their target for what that case may ultimately pay out. And it's a line item in the business records of the company. And it's something that they need to adhere to. And when you're going forward and you want to change that reserve and really make it higher, that's the big no-no. You have to have a big, big, bad, important reasons in order to do it.
Jason, let's kind of break that down a little bit. The overall purpose of the reserve for the insurance company, if you could sum that up, what would you say the actual purpose of this is? Because on the plaintiff side, you know, we tend to think, hey, they're not listening to us. They must be stuck somewhere. Why are they stuck on these numbers? Even though we don't know what they are, what's the actual business purpose of setting the reserve?
Well, it's projecting out monies from the company. And so they have a case, and let's say it's a car wreck case, and it's a lumbar herniation, and we'll say, hey, that's generally like a $350,000 case for purposes of this. So they want to put that in there so that they know that when that case is resolved, that they have those funds in a way set aside, although they're not really set aside. In a way, it's set aside on their books. That's the amount that they're going to pay out. Now, with that, though, is not only the payment for the indemnity portion, you know, for the injury, but it's the budget for the case, the budget for what it's going to take for that defense counsel to work that case up and ultimately try it if it gets that far. So really, it's an accounting, thing.
Well, you said defense counsel aren't involved, and later down the road, we're going to talk about demands. But when it comes to actually maybe changing the reserves, are they asking you questions? Do you know it's about them thinking about changing what they set the reserves at? Or can you tell us any kind of inside information about, you know, or even a story about how that practically happens?
Yeah. Well, so they'll never say, hey, I've got to change my reserve, right? But the question that you would always receive is, hey, wait a minute, what changed? You know, you told me in the beginning of this case that it was a $350,000 case. And now you're telling me it's a policy limit case. You know, what changed? And they can get kind of upset about that because they are, you know, they're not worried about, hey, we need to make this plaintiff whole. Or we need to defend our insured because we think they didn't cause the injury or something like that. They're worried about their job. And they are getting judged by their superiors when they go for their reviews on, you know, did you come in and did you meet your reserves on your cases? Or are they wildly out of whack? Are your reserves too low? And so you had to come in and ask your supervisors for more authority and to reset the reserve. Or are your reserves too high? Because that's also a problem. You know, if they set their reserves too high, then the bookkeeping is all out of whack. And, you know, what the company wants, like any company wants, is able to forecast the profits, forecast expenses. And so when those reserves are out of whack, it looks like that adjuster's not doing their job. And that's, of course, like anybody, they want to keep their job.
Well, Jason, this is where it gets even more interesting for plaintiff's counsel that's never been on the defense side. So it seems like sometimes reserves are set before defense counsel is even involved. Let's say the case has been going a year or longer in jurisdictions that have longer statute of limitations. And then, you know, after the inability of the insurance company to resolve the claim, they then hire defense counsel. If you're not part of that process, how is this happening? Is there little formulas behind the scenes? I know everyone does it differently, but how early do reserves get set?
Well, technically they should get set right away. And I, you know, learned that because I've done some bad faith and defending and trying cases for insurance companies, bad faith. So there's a little bit of pulling back the curtain of that for me. And every company is different. You know, some companies, when a case comes in, it's an automatic $25,000 reserve that's set, irrespective of whether the adjuster does anything with it. But, you know, you have the initial adjusters that they get the case. And they are, irrespective of how big your case is, how big the injuries are ultimately going to be proven to be, they are the lowest level adjusters. And they have no authority. And usually they're new. And if they're not new, boy, there's something wrong with them because they've been there way too long at that level, right? And, you know, we think there's some grand scheme or there's, as you said, a formula. And there's not. There's not. They are simply going on what they think. And what they think then, because they're human, is colored by their motivations and what they want. And they want to look good and they want to look good to their superiors. And so a lot of times what I always found is they're setting these, I think they're setting the reserves low because they're telling me how, you know, the case isn't worth anything when I first get it. But it starts with those initial adjusters and almost always it's going to be out of whack. It's never going to be too high. Almost always it's going to be way too low.
Jason, on the trial by human listserv, we often see attorneys from around the country trying to figure out this reserve thing. And one of the most common questions is, are they discoverable? And if they are discoverable, when and how could a reserve be discoverable? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's going to vary state by state with respect to some of the rules. You know, some states, you know, where you can have a direct action against the insurance company, you know, maybe you can, you know, get the claims file, which might have some of that reserve information in there. I can tell you in the states that I practice, where I defended cases, which was primarily Wyoming, you know, the claims file and those types of things were never discoverable. Once you get past the underlying case and you get into bad faith type of situations, that is when you can get the claims file almost everywhere. And you can then get into the reserve, you know, how the reserves were set and when they were set, because of course that goes into the motivation for the actions that the company took in denying the claim.
And you've talked about motivations and a little bit about adjusters, but could you maybe help break down? You've worked with more with adjusters in your 19 years of defense work than probably anybody that I've known that has switched over to represent plaintiffs. But obviously, these people are humans. We always want to remember the human story. But I think one part of the human story we're not thinking about is, hey, these adjusters are people with a job and family and stuff like that. Could you talk a little bit about adjusters' motivations from your perspective?
Yeah, sure. And, you know, and we touched on it. You know, I think, Jacob, of what you and I do as trial lawyers is we're helping people, you know, first and foremost. Sometimes we're out righting wrongs and we're bending windmills, so to speak. But these guys, these adjusters, you know, they're punching the clock. And they're supporting their family and they're supporting themselves. And it's a job to them. And quite frankly, it's a hard job. You know, nobody likes insurance adjusters. Nobody does. insurance adjusters don't like insurance adjusters. and that's true. And I don't say that to be funny necessarily. But, you know, when I would hear them talk about having to deal with subrogation from other insurance adjusters, you know, they don't like each other and they know the motivations are skewed and what they're doing, even though, you know, they know the game and they're playing the game, but it's a hard job. You know, they have far too many cases and claims for them to handle effectively. They primarily are, you know, until you get to the higher level and bigger cases, you know, your run of the mill, you know, we'll talk just about car wreck cases types of thing, you know, things that are, you know, maybe they're $300,000, maybe they're $500,000 and below. These guys are just overloaded and they don't have time to fully work up their cases. You know, they don't have time to read the reports that are all required of the defense counsel to give them. And they're sort of drowning, quite frankly.
Well, when you think about that, why isn't there more motivation than to get to close the file a little quicker or to get a settlement opportunity finished and complete the case? Because when I did the defense work there, I don't ever remember being told, hey, don't take that deposition or be careful about taking too many depositions. It was, let's go figure out as much as we can. And of course, for me, that was good. If I was traveling around the U.S. taking depositions, that's how I would get paid. But for them, if they are overworked, if there are too many files, why aren't they closing them out faster without forcing plaintiff's attorneys to jump through so many hoops?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, it's because it makes the company money. And it doesn't make sense on individual cases. You know, you would think that you could put a little extra time into it and maybe get it resolved sooner rather than later. But when I say it makes the company money, on a whole, it makes the company money. And so they're continuing with that process. You know, I can't tell you how many times I would get a case in, and in order to learn about it, I would, you know, go through the claims file to see what they did in their investigation. And I would see the negotiations between plaintiff's counsel and the adjuster. And many times you know, they were super reasonable. And, you know, I would look at it and see what the adjuster declined and think, you know, you would be so lucky if you got to settle the case for that amount. And then we would go work the case up. And like you said, it was work it up aggressively, take all the depositions. You know, there's this farce out there that they all promote is, you know, we have separate pots of money for indemnity than we do for defense, which is, I don't think ever the case, but they say that. But then at the end of the day, not only have they, you know, paid the defense firm $100,000 or more to go work up the case, you know, they paid two, three, sometimes four times more than what they could have gotten it done pre-suit. And it never made sense to me. In the later part of my defense career, I did a lot of work for a regional insurance company, and who, in my view, was the best carrier that I ever did work for. And they would take the time to try to resolve cases in a smart way, but big carriers, national carriers, never.
Well, Jason, on our side, there's a lot at stake. Deny justice to someone who's been injured is horrible. Obviously, their lives changed forever because of what happened. But to get justice denied is, you know, adding insult to injury. What's at stake for these adjusters in this kind of game that they are involved in?
You know, I want to say not much. And I think that's true. You know, they're not having to face how to fund a life care plan for themselves or to put food on the table when they can't work. But what's at stake for them is their career. If that's what they're choosing to do, trying to move up the ranks in the company. And so they are trying to make sure all the boxes are checked. And so when they are reviewed by their superiors, that they are a good soldier and they get promoted and they get a raise and they get to keep their job. And so, you know, that's what's at stake. When you get to the, and I know we're going to talk about it at some point, but when you get to what for them would be the scary cases that can be excess cases and can get beyond the policy, that's the stuff that starts to scare them. And that's the stuff that I always saw. That's when they started to pay attention. And very often, all of a sudden, you get a different adjuster talking to me as defense counsel. And you get supervisors talking to me as defense counsel or in-house counsel for the carrier, you know, talking to me. All of a sudden, you know, properly, in my view, focusing on the case. Where if you didn't have that real threat, it's just sort of business as usual.
Well, you said something earlier that is kind of concerning about the adjusters not even reading your notes to them. I remember when we worked together, a plaintiff would come in for his or her deposition, and immediately after I would write to the adjuster about how the person looked, how they carried themselves. You know, they claim they can't sit or stand for more than 10 minutes, but they sat through the deposition just fine. And those are, you know, when I was looking at things through that lens, I would be writing to these adjusters to both tell them the good and bad of the cases, or maybe even there's more exposure than thought. But you having done that for so many years, how are they making good decisions if they're not even taking the time to read what they pay you to write them?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I don't know, because, you know, I can't, it would always happen, or not always, but generally, where I would get a call from an adjuster and they'd be asking me these questions about the case because they're doing their own report, right, that they have to draft up. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, I spent a half a page in detail, you know, with deposition quotes on this in my report. Why didn't you just read my report? And they don't do it often enough because they're too busy. And, you know, I learned over the years from several adjusters, you'd be sitting in a mediation. You know, we as trial lawyers get to sit with with our real clients in the mediation, and it's a hard process, and we sit through that. As a defense counsel, you have to sit with insurance adjusters that again, most of them hate their job, but sometimes they will start talking to you and bitching to you about their job, and you can start to learn a little bit about it. And what I learned is they don't have time to read the reports. And I would ask them, why are you so intent in calling me constantly to get my report in that I was always late on when you don't even read it? And they're checking the box because their supervisors are going to review their files. And in there, I mean, it's all electronic, and they want to see that there was a timely defense counsel report, irrespective of whether it's read, irrespective of whether they're going to follow your advice.
You talked a little bit about this kind of initial adjuster. And another thing that plaintiffs' lawyers want to do, and I have people ask me fairly regularly, well, how can I get past this low-level adjuster? How can I get to the adjuster with more authority? And what has to happen in order to do that? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think pre-suit. So once you file suit, it gets beyond that low-level adjuster. Unless it's a, you know, small fender bender type case. But even then at that small fender bender case, it gets bumped up to an adjuster that is going to handle cases that are filed, right, in litigation. In order to get there prior to filing suit, you have to show them something that scares them, right? I mean, you have to give them, you know, medical records that show big injuries, that show big medical specials that is going to scare them. So that initial adjuster says, hey, this is beyond me. This is beyond my authority. And they're going to bump it up the chain. But unless you can do that pre-suit, you're never going to get beyond those initial adjusters.
And we're going to transition here in a second, but you made me think of something. And one of the last pre-suit demands I did, I included about 240 pages of medical records and everything. But I see some folks on the plaintiff side who think they shouldn't or don't have to share anything until there's a lawsuit filed and they get into the formal discovery process. How does it help the more a plaintiff attorney shares early on in the whole process?
Well, I think it's huge, and I disagree with that philosophy that you don't share, that you call up and say, hey, my people are hurt, you know, here's the accident report, and you've got to pay your policy. In part because in order for them to pay anything out, they need to build their file, and they need to have something in their file to justify why they pay that out. And that's not only, you know, because as we talk about, they get reviewed by supervisors, but all these files also get audited, and they get audited to say, hey, wait a minute, were you justified in paying that policy limit? You know, were you justified in paying, you know, $100,000, you know, $500,000, whatever it might be on a specific claim? And so they need to build their file. And if you don't give them enough initially to start building their file, one, they're not going to take you seriously, I don't think, because they have no reason to. And they have no reason to because they don't have enough in their file. And secondarily, because they don't have enough in their file, they're not going to work with you pre-suit to try to resolve the claim.
Well, it also seems like this might tie back into the reserves issue of plaintiff's counsel refusing to give much or saying you're not getting anything till discovery. They can't do a proper analysis either. So that's just going to start the reserve being set lower than maybe it should be.
For sure. For sure.
Let's go back into, you know, adjusters and handling adjusters. At Trailers for Justice, oftentimes we get asked to come in and help people way down the road. And I'm looking at the file, looking at exchanges. And what I've not been super impressed with is sometimes there's this battle back and forth between plaintiff's counsel and adjuster pre-suit where, you know, there's 3, 5, 10 page letters just really, really kind of thrashing this person as an individual. And that's not something that we subscribe to, but I end up getting involved in cases where that's what's been going on. Can you talk a little bit about how that impacts the case, kind of this attitude and this attempt to bully and stuff like that?
Yeah. Well, it's never helpful. It's never, never helpful. You know, first and foremost, you know, they're people and they don't like to be treated poorly. And if they are treated poorly, you know, the first thing if someone comes in and calls you an asshole is it gets your back up and you say, wait, no, you're an asshole. Right. And if we're doing that, trying to help our clients, well, we're not doing them any good, for sure. And all we're doing is prolonging the process. Now, if you have some situation where it's an excess case to the policy and it's scary, well, I'll still say it's not very effective to treat the adjuster that way. But maybe you can get away with it and you can kind of bully them. But in every other case that's not a policy case, that's not scary for the company, all you're doing is giving that adjuster a reason to go work the case up all the way. And, you know, you're most likely going to see a lot of the same lawyers that you do, probably less so in bigger places than Wyoming, right? But a lot of times the same adjusters or the same carriers. And I would come across adjusters or carriers that would say, yeah, this case isn't a great case to go try, Jason, but this plaintiff's lawyer has taken us a bunch lately, or he's just, again, pardon my language, but they're just an asshole. So go try this case. You know, go punish them a little bit because we want them, we want to slam them down on this case to prevent them from filing what they would say are frivolous cases in the future.
Well, and that certainly does no justice for their client. And I think that's important for people to know. Behind the scenes, it sounds like positions are being taken sometimes based off a bad lawyer's bad attitude.
Oh, for sure. And it goes, you know, it's battles and wars, right? You know, I think rightfully so, think of ourselves, we are. I mean, we're standing up against the boys. We're standing up against the giants that want to not only deny justice, but a lot of times do injustice to our clients. But the way to do that isn't always to stand in front of them and throw rocks, but it is to be nice, you know, work the system, do things effectively to, at the end of the day, maximize what you can do for your client and maximize that justice, irrespective of whether at the end of the day you feel great because, you know, you got to pound on the insurance company or pound on the defense counsel. If you can do it effectively, then that's what we're here for.
So is there a time where you being nice isn't good enough? Is there a time in a case with adjuster where things do switch, or should people have the attitude, I'm always going to maintain the high road, or does sometimes being firm actually get you somewhere?
Well, yes, I think there is that time, and it reminds me, it's a terrible movie, but it's one of my favorite scenes in Roadhouse, where you have Patrick Swayze as the bouncer trying to teach the young bouncers how to do their job. And what he says is, you need to be nice. And they prod him about this and all these different scenarios. And he says, be nice until it's time to not be nice. And, you know, we know that when that comes, and when that comes with respect to handling adjusters in this general pre-suit, right? When you're giving deadlines for responding to policy limit demands or responding to demands. And of course they always want time, right? I just gave an extra 20 days last week on a case. It's a policy case and I probably shouldn't have. But I did it out of a favor, quite frankly, to the defense counsel. But those are the times that you can then be firm. And then when you're firm, you stand on it. And when you tell these adjusters or defense counsel, hey, this is your one shot. And, you know, whether I give you an extension or not, you're not going to get this chance again. And we're going to go try the case. Well, then you go try the case. Because if you don't then follow that up, then they're going to know every time in the future. Well, he or she says this, but they're going to settle the case later on. So we don't have to pay attention to them. So taking that firm stance, there is that time for that firm stance. And that's, you know, there are other examples, of course, but that's the big one that comes to mind.
Now, I want to, again, you keep saying really, I think, important stuff for us as plaintiff attorneys to be paying attention to. But you talked a little bit about change. I was asking about change as far as adjusters. But when you have a case, let's say a kind of run-of-the-mill car wreck, the person goes from chiropractic care to a couple injections, and a year later ends up being surgical. How does that look, and kind of what's happening behind the scenes? And how would you look at that as a defense attorney? Did you think they're shopping for a doctor? Did you think they just complained enough, they finally got it? How, because that's a big change to us. We think it's a big change. And of course,
sure.
The majority of the time our clients are honest people, and this is real stuff. But how are those changes looked at, and what were you doing with adjusters and insurance companies behind the scenes when these kind of changes would happen?
Well, boy, what I would do as defense counsel a lot of times is try to explain why it's important. And part of that is, you know, the adjuster sees that stuff all the time. You know, they see that progression from injections moving on to surgery, or at least the threat of surgery. And I'll tell you, you know, there are some places in this country where the medical care, it's kind of a mill, and they run it through. They run it through, and they run it folks through chiropractic care, and then they progress on to neurosurgical care. And it's somewhat of a game with respect to workers' comp type cases and personal injury cases. And they have this the physicians, and it's rare, but it happens. They have this close relationship with plaintiff's lawyers. And quite frankly, it's gross, and it shouldn't happen. And I think it's something that is known in the insurance industry and the defense, on the defense side, that sort of casts a big shadow across legitimate claims. And so getting back to what you said, you know, when the adjuster sees it, I don't think it means much to them because they have this jaundiced eye to all of that stuff. You know, very rarely would I ever talk to an adjuster, and an adjuster would say, "Oh man, this guy's really hurt. It looks like let's go figure out how, and let's figure out whether our guy did." Usually, it was that jaundiced eye of, you know, oh, they're probably lying, and plaintiff's counsel's probably lying, and all they want is money. And so, what I would do as defense counsel is really having to disabuse them of that. And like you said, it's very rare. I in my career, it was very rare that I ever found somebody that wasn't truthful on the plaintiff's side. You know, I mean, usually they're all hurt, and it's whether or not, you know, my guy did it or caused it, or legally there's a way to get around it. So I would generally spend that time disabusing the adjuster that it's not fake. Right, that it is real, and that we need to pay attention to it.
So this is another thing on the plaintiff side that I hear people across the country talking about. Is it enough to get the surgical recommendation, or should we always be having the clients follow all the way through with it before proceeding with the lawsuit? And of course, statute of limitations matter and stuff like that. But if their choice from the defense perspective, does the recommendation enough trigger the money, or was there more want to see the person go all the way through with it?
My thought is it's always better to go through with it, because you have the recommendation from the orthopedist saying you need a fusion or what have you. And so you have that. Well, on the defense side, they're going to get an IME physician that, you know, surprise is going to say, oh no, they don't need surgery. You know, we can do this through conservative treatment, and they're going to be just fine. So the recommendation itself, I never found it much.
In this relationship that you had with adjusters, which again is something that plaintiff's counsel never gets access to, would you see some of their stresses come alive, or did you kind of feel some of the pain with them as these cases progress?
You know, so like stresses of just of their job, et cetera.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, it stands out to me. I had this case. It was, I think the insurance policy was maybe only $100,000, and the case itself was, you know, like $800, over $1 million case as far as the injury goes. And the adjuster really wanted to get this resolved, and they wanted to close the case. But the plaintiff's lawyer legitimately had to jump through these hoops and had to get things set up on his side in order to be able to accept the offer. And the adjuster was so frustrated because, I mean, it took over a year to get this done. He would call me up and he would talk about his supervisors on his butt because there was nothing in the file and the case wasn't progressing. And he would ask me just to get on Westlaw and send him some cases. It didn't have to have anything to do with the case, but he just wanted to put something in his file to show his supervisors that it was being worked. And so, you know, I would feel that periodically from them. You know, for the most part, you know, I'm sort of reading the tea leaves of where their frustrations come from. But that's an example of being able to see it firsthand, the pressures that they're under. And again, it's better for the company. Just hold off. You know, you've got issues with the reserve, I suppose, but you're making money on your investments. You know, hold off until you have to pay it. But this guy was just intent on making his record look good, so that it looks like he's working his cases and he's timely closing his cases.
When you're talking about closing, though, there's definitely confusion, and I've been confused over the years too. Is the goal for these companies to learn what they can and settle the case, or is the goal to push to trial? It's very inconsistent across the board. And do you have any observations from your 19 years in that foxhole?
Yeah, it is different, and it's cyclical. There would be times that you would get cases, and it would just be a rush to get them settled. And I would be, and rarely did I ever say this to an adjuster, hey, you're paying too much on this case. Usually I'm trying to do dental surgery on them to get more money. So there would be times like that, and not across the board, that I would see, but just with different companies where they would want to settle cases. And then a year or two later, they were going to trial their cases. And it goes to, you know, whatever sort of, you know, quote unquote, money ball theory that they ascribe to for that time period with respect to how they're overall going to save money. When I, in the latter part of my defense career, going to some national meetings with lawyers who were doing national work for medical negligence companies, you know, they would do studies and they would look at how much money they could save overall if they would trial their cases versus if they would work them up initially and try to settle them ahead of trial. And at that point, and that was probably, well, it's probably 2016 or so. At that point, the study showed, hey, we can ultimately save more money, which make more money for the company, if we trial our medical malpractice cases. And so it's cyclical, and it's whatever new theory they ascribe to.
My gosh, it's absolutely nothing we can count on. And I guess that jives with exactly what my experience is as well, because the fact of the matter is every single time a case is worked up and worked up well, more money is on the table. But talk about a thankless job being an adjuster. I've never met one at a career day, but I'm not sure that I'd recommend that profession for anybody. If you have any comments on that,
work with them. You know, when I first started as a young lawyer, and in my firm, you know, you're doing the terrible work, the $25,000 limit cases, and usually a lot of those $25,000 limit cases are the catastrophic cases, right? That you're not going to go work up. You're just trying to, you're trying to get them settled. And I would get all these adjusters who are hyper aggressive at that level because they're trying to move up the chain, right? And I would come to my father. And one of the things that I cherish about my defense career, not only about the perspective that I got, but I got to practice with my dad. And so when he was in town and I was in town, I got to see him every day. And I remember distinctly early on going to him and talking to him about these adjusters and how, you know, kind of mean they were and how they're not listening to me. And his response was, he said, Jason, you know, there's never been a little girl or a little boy that tugged on their father's pant leg and looked up and said, Daddy, when I grow up, I want to be an insurance adjuster. And I think that's true. One, because it's a little bit obscure, right? It's not a firefighter or a Navy SEAL. But it's a weird, thankless, hard job.
Absolutely. And that's such a great quote, Jason. I love that. And we will put that in the show notes. So for everyone listening, I really hope you're enjoying this episode, and make sure you stay tuned for part two of this interview, where we cover the anatomy of the defense attorney, how they view their cases, their relationship with insurance adjusters, and the challenges of defending personal injury cases.